our first record was really hypey on the internet. I didn't feel like a fully formed person yet, and so hearing all this nice stuff on the internet was really gratifying at some level. But as the years wear on, I try to sequester myself from it a little more, because I think it definitely does change the way you think about yourself as an artist and what sort of what lane you're in. And if you allow other people to define that, all is lost, I guess.
93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Stephen Hayden.
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93X FM here in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. My guest today is Joseph D'Agostino. He is the lead singer and songwriter for Cymbals Eat Guitars, a really great band that is putting out its fourth record, Pretty Years, in September. I had a really great conversation with Joseph. We talked about the history of the band, as well as what it's like to be an indie band in 2016. You know, a band that is trying to make great music, trying to exist outside the pop system, and how difficult that can be. Even if you are a band that people love and are talking about, it doesn't necessarily translate into lots of money. So it was a really great conversation with Joseph. He was pretty candid talking about that. So that was a lot of fun. I just want to say too that if you're listening to this podcast right now, I'm really grateful that you clicked on it, because we are talking about a band that maybe you haven't heard of before, that this might be your introduction to the band. And it's always a tricky thing to talk about music that people are unfamiliar with, especially now. We are in a music culture that is very much geared towards people who are already superstars. A lot of the stories that you read on music websites are about the biggest stars in the world. Those are the people that sort of dominate the conversation, and they dominate the clicks. So to talk about a band, that's still up and coming, and to make a case for them being an important band, is always a tricky thing. But for me, Cymbals Eat Guitars, they justify that kind of attention. They put out their first record in 2009, and they've put out, three records after that. And they are a band that I feel like is really, evolving in a way that you don't see it from a lot of bands. I mean, they started out as this sort of indie rock group that drew a lot from 90s indie. Bands like Built to Spill, Modest Mouse. When I talked to Joseph, he talks about Weezer being a big inspiration for the band. But over time, they've really moved in a very kind of sophisticated direction. I mean, there's prog rock elements in this band. There's emo elements in this band. Musically, they kind of go through these waves that feel psychedelic and feel really naughty and weird, but at the same time, the songs are very accessible. And especially on the new record, Pretty Years, they've really moved in sort of an anthemic rock direction. These songs are very punchy, they're very direct, they're very melodic. I would say that this is the record that, if you are just learning about this band, that this is the record that's going to hook you. This record has the sharpest hooks. It has the most sort of succinct songwriting. And it's really a record that you can put on in your car and blast it and drive really fast and do all those things that you like to do to really fun rock and roll records. But again, even if you are a band like Cymbals Eat Guitars that is making great records and is getting really good reviews and gets covered by all the big websites, it's not necessarily something that makes it easy to survive, that you still have to find a way to carve a niche for yourself in a music scene where there isn't always a niche for bands like this. So on this podcast, I like to support groups like this, to give them an avenue that they can talk about their art and hopefully turn people on to their music. So I hope you guys enjoy this interview. I think Joseph is a really thoughtful guy. He has a lot of great things to say. Here it is. Joe, thanks for coming on the podcast, man.
My pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So I've been listening to Pretty Years now. I feel like I got a promo of this like a month or two ago. So I've been living with it for a while. It's weird to think that this record, we're talking in mid-August So we're another month out from this record being released. But I've been lucky enough. I've been able to live with it for a while. And I love it. I think it's great. So
thank you so much.
Congratulations with that. You know, you're at this point right now. You're waiting for the record to come out. When do you actually go out on tour for this record?
We do a few warm-up shows before September 15th, which is like our record release show at Music Hall of Williamsburg in Brooklyn. And then the record comes out on the 16th. So, you know, we get to sell copies of the vinyl and the CDs at the record release show. And it's really fun. But, yeah, we'll be out on tour basically from September 7th until, you know, mid to late October.
Okay. And when you're at this point, I mean, yeah, the record's been done for a while and you're just waiting for it to come out. Like, what's your mindset right now? Are you excited to get out there? Are you impatient? Like, what's the mindset?
Well, every time it's very stressful. You know, you finish something and you're super excited about it. And you try to just be in love with it for as long as you're able to be. And then, you know, generally once the first single goes out, which is somehow still, you know, 4 months ahead of time, which is crazy, it kind of is not yours anymore, and people start forming opinions on it and, you know, adding you on Twitter and stuff. And it's just like, okay, now I need to, now it's a thing that doesn't belong to me. And, I'm ready to just go out and play these songs, and watch them change in the live setting.
Yeah. You know, I've had this conversation with, you know, a bunch of musicians that have come on the podcast, and I'm always curious about what it's like for an artist in 2016. You know, this, you know, we live in this world where it's really hard to sequester yourself from the opinions of other people, you know, and I imagine, you know, like if you're a creative person, go ahead.
I was just going to say Brooklyn Vegan deleting their comments section helped.
I mean, is that something that you, I mean, do you seek out, like when you put out a single, like are you looking online, are you looking to see what people think, or do you want to block that out? I mean, because I'm always curious about, like, you know, hearing those voices. Is that helpful, or does it sort of impede the creative process at all?
It's really hard to say. For my, like, my personal trajectory in music, like, our first record was really hypey on the internet. So when I was younger, you know, I was 20 years old or 19 years old when that record came out, you know, a lot of people were saying a lot of really nice things, and I was just like, you know, this kid from New Jersey, and I didn't feel like a fully formed person yet. And so hearing all this nice stuff on the internet, reading all this nice stuff was really gratifying on some level. But as the years wear on, I try to sequester myself from it a little more, because I think it definitely does change the way you think about yourself as an artist and what sort of what lane you're in. And if you allow other people to define that, you know, then it's all is lost, I guess.
Yeah. You know, before we talk about the new record, I want to just ask a little bit about your background. Like, do you still live in New Jersey?
No, right now I live in Philadelphia, in East Kensington. But I grew up, I was born in Brooklyn, and, you know, my family lived in New York, on Staten Island for 5 years. And then when it was time for me to go, you know, into school, they moved to Jersey. In like 94. So we moved to Weirton, New Jersey, which is sort of across from Long Beach Island, but on, you know, on the mainland. And I did all of my, I went through school there. And then later we moved back to New York when I went to Fordham, in 2006.
And so, when did you start, you know, listening to music and caring about music and thinking about it?
I didn't really start thinking about it until probably the ninth grade, high school. You know, I started making friends that cared about it, and being in bands started to become more of a thing that people were doing. Although at that time, when I was in high school, a lot of the bands were sounding like, you know, Panic at the Disco, and there was a lot of screamo happening. You know, so I wasn't in that type of band, but we would. My friend introduced me to, you know, Weezer. That's how it happens, and then kind of everything branched out from there. Love of rock music.
So, like Weezer was sort of like the gateway band for you.
Definitely, yeah. Blue Album, Weezer, and from there it just took off.
Like what about Weezer? Like, why was that the band?
Geez, I don't know. I think a lot of people get stuck on those first two albums. I think it was simple enough for me to digest at the time. There were like big, you know, broad, relatable, you know, sentiments, especially for teenage boys.
Right.
and there was some really satisfying kind of visceral, like gut punch moments in those songs. You know, like my first real emotional reaction to a guitar solo, for instance, you know, Say It Ain't So.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, there's some special magic.
And I mean, you made like a somewhat disparaging comment about how a lot of people at that time were listening to, like, you know, Panic at the Disco and sort of like the pop emo, pop punk thing. I mean, Weezer is an interesting band because they are, you know, they kind of have one foot in like alternative rock and punk-ish type stuff, and yet the other foot is, you know, very much a classic rock type tradition. I mean, is it fair to say that that was sort of the track you were put on with that sort of like hybrid of like kind of like indie punk stuff and classic rock?
Definitely, that kind of sums me up, I guess.
like, where did you go from there musically?
Well, you know, following that, I started to get into more 90s indie rock. You know, in my teens, I just fell in love with the Pavement records, and I loved, you know, Modest Mouse and Built to Spill, and, you know, all the stuff that our first record kind of, you know, referenced. everybody has probably gets into Radiohead at some point.
Yeah.
Feels really sophisticated, and I did. I think Hail to the Thief might have been one of the first albums that I bought, a weird special edition with the poster, which I actually have on my wall here still.
Oh, wow.
No Way Out, Gallows, Could Do, Wax Eyes. You know.
I like the
very
top.
Serious music.
Oh,
very,
yeah.
Very serious.
I mean, like, I mean, I feel like prog rock gets mentioned in your review sometimes. I mean, was that ever something that you cared about or listened to?
No, not I mean, bands. There were bands with proggy elements to them, but I never listened to, like, what is like proper prog rock, like King Crimson and like Yes and stuff.
Yeah, or I mean, I don't. Were you like a Mars Volta guy or anything like that in the 2000s?
No, I wasn't. I guess I liked At the Drive-In a little bit.
Right.
There's definitely some really crazy song structures and insane drumming and feats of technical prowess. Although that never really became something that I was terribly interested in for myself. Like, I never sat there in my room practicing pentatonic scales or whatever kind of scales. And even now, I don't really feel like I have too much of a grasp on the guitar, you know, in a traditional way. I basically just learned to play lead guitar by getting a Frantone Peach Fuzz and like an Ibanez Tube Screamer and kicking them both on and just kind of, wailing aimlessly until I arrived at something that sounded kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think with your records, I wouldn't necessarily call them proggy, although they do have, they're not proggy in sort of the form of the songs, but there is sort of a proggy feel sometimes, and I think it just comes from like how layered your records feel. Like there is something very direct about your records that, they're melodic and they're catchy and, they're immediate, but then there's also different stuff going on that you maybe don't pick up right away. It's like the 10th listen or something. You're like, oh wow, that thing's going on in that song.
And it's just kind of a general sense of bombast maybe that we share with some of those bands.
Yeah. Like you mentioned ninth grade being like a turning point for you. Like, were you writing songs by that point?
You know, I was. My first show was at a guitar academy, the Toms River Guitar Academy. And I was in a 4-piece rock band, 2 guitars, bass, drums. But really, it was only 1 guitar because I just held my guitar. I didn't actually know how to play it yet. And I believe that we covered Tired of Sex by Weezer. Now, I was 13 at the time. My voice hadn't changed yet.
But you were already tired of sex, though, at that point.
So tired of thinking about sex. for 18 hours a day,
So anyway,
I got away from the question.
Yeah, you're at the camp and you're holding your guitar and you played Tired of Sex.
Yeah, but didn't play it, just sang it.
So you did that when you were 13 and writing songs kind of happened around that time?
Yeah, writing songs started to happen, shortly after that, like 14 or 15. I had been playing music for longer than I was interested in it because my mother was really into the idea of me, having an instrument and having that in my life because she always wanted it. She played guitar for a while when she was a teenager, but gave it up. So she had me started on the piano since I was, 7 or 8, actually, I would say, because I took 10 years of piano lessons. So once I started to get a handle on actually playing the guitar and not just holding it, I was able to kind of like form some songs pretty quickly. So it happened around 14 or 15, and there were some really terrible cock rock songs.
Like what?
Just like big riffy, like terrible, okay. I saw Jet at Roseland Ballroom. Make of that what you will.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, so like, and actually Sloan opened, so that was really cool. Oh. But again, like, really riffy kind of stuff. So I was writing that for about a year.
No judgments here, by the way. I will defend some of the songs on Get Born. I think if for like, especially if you've been drinking for a while, and Get Born comes on.
For 10 years or so.
It's the shit. Cold Hard Bitch, that's like a great AC/DC ripoff. I'll defend that song.
Yeah.
I just kind of winced when I said that title, because it's like a very...
Yeah.
Title. It sounds like a...
2016.
Like a, yeah, it's not very woke as a album, as a song title, but it works as a song, especially, again, if you've been drinking Old Milwaukee for about 3 or 4 hours, and then that song comes on. Something Pavlovian takes over, I think.
Like Rollover DJ.
Yeah.
That song's kind of fun. Yeah. And then there's that Stones ballad.
Look What You've Done. Yeah, that's a...
Yeah.
Song? It's like a Stonesy Oasis type thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But you don't you don't like Oasis, right? Because I remember you giving... I tweeted something about Oasis once, and I think you like said something.
That was before I read some of your book.
because you like Blur, you like Blur, right?
I love Blur.
There you go.
Blur is my good friend. A lot of my good friends, our friendships are mostly formed on the basis of being Blur fans. I love them to death. I saw them at Madison Square Garden recently in October with my mom, and it was just fucking awesome. It was one of the best shows I've ever seen. I loved it so much.
The funny thing about that show is that my friend Joe was at that show, and he was texting me photos of like empty seats in the arena, saying like, "Oh, look how empty it is here." And because I'm a big Oasis fan, so he was like trying to like show that there weren't that many people at the MSG show.
I don't think it was. Yeah, it wasn't fully sold out. But I mean, it felt pretty good by the time they went on.
Oh yeah.
You know, it didn't seem like there were like, you know, sections that weren't full. But there were seats here and there. And also, Courtney Barnett opened that show, and she just was unbelievable. Like, for a trio to do that on a stadium stage, she's just, like, so magnetic.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen her play a few times in smaller settings than that, and she's just great. She's one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah. She has that, like, rock star, like, charisma big time.
She really does.
You made reference to this before about the first Symbols E Guitars record, which came out in 2009, called Why There Are Mountains, being sort of a buzzy record. And you were saying that you were like 19, 20 years old when that record came out. Is that right?
That is right, yeah. So I believe when it formally came out, I was 20 years old, but it was made when I was 18 and 19. Yeah.
Okay, so you hadn't even been writing songs for a whole long time. You know, you were still a really young guy, you know, only been writing songs for 3 or 4 years, and now this record comes out and, you know, is well received. Looking back on that, like, what was that like? I mean, I can see that being really exciting at the time, but also potentially being damaging in a way, you know, to have to experience
that at such a
young age. Like, what was that like?
Well, you know, at the time when everything was happening, I felt like, oh my God, I just self-actualized. Like, I wished for something for so long, or what felt like so long. Like you say, it was only, you know, four or five years that I was writing songs in earnest. But at that time, I was just like, every time I catch an 11-11 or whatever, I wish that I could be in a touring band and, you know, have the world pay attention to my art or whatever. And I had all these outsized ambitions about what I thought rock music was and what it could accomplish and, you know, the places that it might take me. It was a very exciting time. You know, we got to open for a lot of greats, you know, Flaming Lips and like Hold Steady and, you know, huge shows in London and big festivals. And it was really fun, but also I don't know if I was able to fully enjoy it or appreciate how crazy it is that it was even happening. Just because of, the touring schedule was so crazy, and you have to understand, Pitchfork Festival 2009 was like something like our eighth show.
Wow. Okay.
And that's no exaggeration. Like, I got the people together, at first on Craigslist, and then there were, you know, various replacements over a couple months when people bowed out or, you know, couldn't do the touring schedule. It was just insane, and we were thrust into all of these situations, and we probably didn't sound very good. I mean, we definitely didn't sound very good. Every time Pitchfork posts about us, it seems like they still post this video from Pitchfork Festival 2009 of us playing the first track off of our debut album and the Hazy Sea, and it's just like so awful.
I was going to say that.
Like, I can't sing. Like, I can't sing, and we fucking just can't play at all together, and it just is so ramshackle. But, you know, maybe that was part of the charm.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that. Like, I would not want to be reminded of my 19-year-old self all the time. You know, that
no,
was,
I was terrible.
I mean,
just musically.
Yeah, like, for me personally, that was like the gawkiest time of my life, arguably, or one. I mean, there's many contenders for that distinction in my life, but like that'd be kind of awkward to have that brought up all the time. So I mean,
yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I mean, now, at least it seems to me, the people that who are coming to our shows these days, or who came out on the lose cycle, or, you know, who've kind of stuck with us, you know, I don't hear very many requests from the audience for, like, songs from that first record very much anymore. Whereas for a while, it was all we heard. We're still, you know, kind of people who are hanging around from the hypey first record, you know, into the crazy proggy second record. Actually, okay, yes, we were a prog band, because Lenses Alien is totally like a fucking emo prog record.
Well, and that's what's interesting, like for me, as far as approaching your band, because I came to your band with Lenses Alien. That was the first record I heard. So, and the first record still, like, I don't know, that's the record I know the least. Like, I know Lenses Alien and Lose and the new one. I know all those records really well. But I mean, because Lenses Alien was a record, as you say, it was this sort of, you know, it's a very naughty record in a lot of ways. It's very, it's proggy, it's kind of psychedelic. I think it's a beautiful record. I like it a lot. But I mean,
well, thank you.
That kind of drove you over a cliff a little bit commercially, didn't it, at the time?
Yeah, well, you know, I think we were experiencing all of, I mean, that's how it happens, I guess, for everybody who releases records now, is like you make a record and it does whatever it does, and then you go away for a year to make another, and while you're gone, the music industry just totally changes, you know, so that it's unrecognizable from what you remembered from the last time you put out a record. So, yeah, I mean, the first record sold really well because we were at a time in the internet where the hype from blogs drove record sales. And so the record did pretty well, and we self-released it, quote unquote. I mean, you know, we worked with a distributor, but it was our own little label. And the second record we signed with a proper, you know, major indie, Barsuk. And the sales just completely fell off, because I think 2011 was not a year for that kind of record.
Yeah.
At all.
And even right, and even Lose. I mean, Lose has been, I think, I mean, when I talk to people who are into like rock music, like that's a record, that's a big record. People love that record. And in a way, I mean, do you feel like that record sort of rebooted the band in a way? I mean, I feel like, I think in terms of like just your media coverage or profile, it seemed like people were talking about your band in sort of a different way because of that record. I mean, was that your sense?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there was, you know, like you said, I mean, it drove us over, Lenses Alien drove us over a sort of a, you know, we didn't sell any records, and we didn't get many tours, and we kind of freaked out, and we're like, oh my God, this isn't happening anymore. We need we need backup plans, and we need plan B, whatever. Music isn't going to work out as a career. And we had some lineup shifting. You know, our original drummer, who is a high school friend of mine, left the band and was replaced by Andy, our current drummer, and that kind of really changed everything. When I think back on it, because we wrote Lose together, you know, me, Brian, Matt, and Andy, and Andy was such a positive influence, and an incredible drummer, and just you know, he has kind of an indomitable spirit on the road and in the studio. He's just an extremely positive person, and it just kind of pushed us through to make some really good songs. And you know, I had been waiting to write about the subject matter that I wrote about on Lose, because I didn't feel like I had the skills as a lyricist or a poet or whatever to do it justice, because it was this thing that you know, Ben's death was just something that really loomed large over, and still does, over my life. And so
could you talk, I'm sorry, just for people who aren't familiar with that story, could you just kind of briefly talk about that a little
bit? Oh, well, I am. Yeah, sure. Sorry. Yeah. When I was 18, And Ben was 19. He passed away of a heart-related condition in his sleep around this time.
And it's like a boyhood friend of yours, right?
Boyhood friend of mine, yeah. We were, you know, music pals. I mean, he played in the band right before Cymbals and Guitars, which was actually it was called Joseph Ferocious. and we had little projects and we'd record together and we were, you know, just kind of, you know, best friends. He had an amazing band too. We were just, we had our own little support system kind of thing. Because he lived in Freehold, New Jersey, and I lived, 35 minutes south. And so we actually met playing a house show in somebody's garage in West Caldwell, New Jersey, and became fast friends. So, yeah, when Ben passed away, it was like a bomb exploded in my life and, and everybody who knew him. Yeah, so that's who he is, and that's who Lose was. I mean, not to say that all of Lose was about Ben, but his the ghost of him kind of hangs over it in a big way.
And you said that because that happened obviously several years before that record came out. I mean, you felt like you had to kind of get to a point as a writer where you could even write about something like that.
Yeah. I think the first two records were really. Really, they seem to me to be try hard, not to like dismiss them. I mean, I'm proud of them, but lyrically there was a lot of $10 words going on and a lot of, really trying to be highbrow and trying to be a poet. And on Lose, I feel like maybe I had settled into the idea of just, being a good rock lyricist and, making that distinction kind of for the first time. I think Warning was the first song that we wrote for Lose. And then right after that was Jackson. And I was like, okay, this is ready. This has to happen now. This is the record.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what sets you apart, from a lot of, other people right now in terms of like as being a songwriter is the lyrics, and you definitely put a premium on specificity in your lyrics. There is sort of like they're very evocative in that way as far as creating a world that your songs exist in. How did you get to that point, I guess, as a writer? Like who were you listening to? Like, what were your influences? Like, and how did you evolve, I guess, in that way?
Well, I was 16 when I heard Meadowlands by the Wrens for the first time.
Yeah.
And I've talked about it before, I'm sure, but that record just completely changed my life. Being from New Jersey and growing up there, I have this sort of mystical, spiritual connection to, the Pine Barrens where I grew up and just like, it's very close to my heart, and I felt like the Meadowlands really captured that essence of exactly what I grew up in. The crickets and the passing cars on House That Guilt Built. Just like when I put that record on the turntable, it brings me right back to my weird, lonely childhood. So once I heard that, I was just like, I want to transport people with art. Even if they're not from New Jersey, I want them to wonder what it's like. I want them to wonder, I want them to be able to put themselves inside of my world a little. And you're right, it is very much about world building. So from the time, I didn't do it all that much on the first record, but in the second record, I started talking about, these towns in New Jersey that I had spent time in and hung out in. And, there was a song called Shore Points and all that. And then, later on Lose, there were many name drops, I feel like, although I can't remember them specifically at this moment. But
I mean, it's amazing. I've never been to New Jersey, but because I, you know, listen to your band and Bruce Springsteen and Titus Andronicus, you know, there's just this tradition of bands and musicians from New Jersey who write about that state in a very eloquent way, where I feel like I know the reality of that state, and I also have this sort of romanticized alternate version of New Jersey in my head. So, like, should I never go to New Jersey? Is this like the best of Jersey right now in my mind?
Just from listening to these songs? Well, yeah, I think it absolutely is. Well, no, actually, okay, look, first of all, crazy that you've never been to New Jersey.
I would like to. Like, Hoboken seems cool. I've been close. Yeah. I've been close to Jersey. I've been to Philadelphia and I've been to New York, but not in between.
Hoboken seems cool, huh?
Is it not?
No, it's not. We call it Broboken.
Well, when I say Hoboken is cool, what I'm really saying is I like Yola Tango.
Yeah, of course.
I'm a Yola Tango fan, so that's what I'm really saying there. Or are the Feelies from Hoboken?
Yeah, they're from New Jersey. I'm not sure if it's Hoboken or, you know, but yeah, they're a Jersey band.
See, this is what I mean. It's like all of my knowledge is from these bands that I love.
I think that that's nice. I think that you should preserve that. But most people's impression of New Jersey is what they see from New York or what they see when they come out of the Holland Tunnel. And those parts of North Jersey are, you know, they smell bad and, like, the refineries make the air shitty and, you know, it's just like I-95. But where I grew up is very different, and I always tell people this. I mean, Long Beach Island is the tri-state area's destination for vacations for a reason. It's like incredibly beautiful, pristine beaches, and that's kind of, you know, that's from where I'm from. Like, I spent every day on the beach when I was a youngster and a teen. So it's all just, to me, New Jersey means a bunch of, like, it just means beauty. Where I grew up in, you know, my house in 1994 when we moved, my house was kind of the only house on the block because it was a brand new development, sort of in the middle of the woods. So I just spent a lot of time, you know, in nature in that way, just going out in my backyard and there's endless woods behind it.
See, and you said Pine Barrens too, which of course makes me think of The Sopranos.
Oh yeah, I'm just finishing a rewatch, by the way. Oh, my girlfriend and I.
I'm in the middle of like my fourth rewatch right now. It's phenomenal.
Fourth.
Oh yeah, man. That's like for my wife and I, that's like, you know, a semi-annual tradition. Like every couple of years, we'll go watch Sopranos again, and Pine Barrens, of course. For people who do not watch The Sopranos, is what's the title of a very famous episode involving?
Really quite an episode.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, I'm just thinking of, like, you know, wounded Russians wandering around in the woods, maybe where you grew up.
Well, just imagine the setting of that episode without all the gunplay and the pompadour, the silver pompadour with wings, and you'll kind of have a pretty accurate picture of it.
Yeah. So, I want to talk to you, you know, I mean, you're still young. I think you're 27, right?
Yeah, I'm 27.
But you've already, you know, you've kind of been through the wars a little bit, you know, as far as being a musician. This is going to be your fourth record coming out. And, you know, I don't want to out you too much, but I mean, we were talking a little bit before we got on the phone, you know, just emailing a little bit, and it sounds like you're excited about the record, but you're also dealing with some sort of frustrations just from being in a band for this long. I mean, is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's definitely fair to say. You don't have to worry about outing me. I'll tell anybody who'll still listen.
I mean,
what my experience has been, you know.
I mean, like, what are your feelings right now? I mean, you know, you're at this point. I think that you are. I think Simple Z Guitars again is a band that for those of us that are engaged with rock and roll right now, that are excited about new bands, that you are, I think you're considered among the best bands right now, that, you know, especially now. I mean, you're at the point now where you have like a good body of work. I think four albums now. It's clear that, okay, this band isn't just going to kind of come and go, that they're a consistently great band. So you have this, I think, really great reputation, and yet you're also a band. I think like a lot of bands, you're not, it's not like you're hugely successful. You know, you have to work hard to make whatever money that you're making. And I'm sure it's a big grind to keep it going. I mean, the creative experience in this band, I imagine, is much different than sort of the business experience of being in this band. I mean, like, where are you at right now in terms of that?
Well, I'm glad that we didn't talk 2 weeks ago when we were supposed to, because
really?
I would have been, yeah, I was just in a terrible place.
Oh, man.
You know, like we were talking about before, the four-month rollout is just agonizingly slow. And it just, you know, it's very hard to get people to focus on something or pay attention to something when there are, you know, millions of other things that they could be paying attention to. And, you know, for me personally right now, I don't listen to indie rock that much. I feel like I don't even listen to music that much right now. And it just feels strange to be asking people to do that. It feels hypocritical to be like, you should pay attention to this rock record because I made it. When I don't, you know, when I'm just not that engaged myself right now in what's going on.
I mean, is that different? So I mean, were there times like before this where you felt more engaged in that regard?
Yeah, I feel, I mean, you know, there was a time when music was the only thing that mattered to me. But I guess that's reaching back pretty far. You know, once I got involved in the music business, I think that things changed that you can't, you can't ever go back to that pure way that you felt, after you've grinded it out. I mean, maybe some people can, but I made my whole, because I was so young when the band started, I built my whole identity around being a guitar player and a songwriter in a band. And to think that, you know, maybe that's not going to happen in the way that I envisioned it, just kind of, you know, is a little bit of a bummer. But I think no matter what happens with this band, I can't stop writing music. I have, you know, lots and lots of GarageBand demos and songs and things. Could probably release a Guided by Voices style album at this point. I'm getting off topic here.
No, I mean, what? I don't want,
I don't want to meander. I don't want to.
Well, and I don't want you to rant or something in a way that you don't want to. I don't want you to vent too much if you kind of want to keep that private. I guess I'm just curious about what exactly do you find frustrating at this point? Is it, do you feel frustrated? Do you wish that the band, was more popular, or that you had a bigger kind of imprint?
I guess it's you know, I mean, all the members of our band kind of, we put our lives on hold to go on tour, and we really we struggle to come out even, or to take home a tiny bit of money, maybe to cover rent while we're away. It would feel good to, you know, be booked for some American festivals, which we haven't really done since 2010. I mean, you know, played Lollapalooza and all this shit, and then since then nothing. At the same time, I don't know. It feels like. I feel really entitled to ask for that, to be able, I want to make a living in this crazy way. I want to write these weird rock songs, and I want a lot of people to like it. It doesn't seem reasonable in 2016.
Yeah. I think you're just being honest. I think anyone that puts their art out there wants it to be, seen and heard and experienced, and you want to make an impact. And you guys are certainly making an impact. I mean, do any of these frustrations, I guess, translate to, I guess, sort of like a larger thing about just rock bands in general in 2016, like what kind of impact they have? I mean, do you think about it ever in those terms? Like kind of like a bigger way, like.
Sure, outside of myself, you mean?
Yeah, like, you know, just, yeah. You know, like you were saying before, this, it may seem like a lot to ask for any rock band of your ilk or something to have an impact, you know? Does that ever, like, just sort of like that kind of marginalization, does that ever get frustrating?
Yeah, but, you know, I think this is a funny thing to be saying. Rock had its time. I mean, rock had its cultural zenith, you know, I guess, maybe, in the 90s, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I emailed David Berman, not to, like, be name-droppy, or, like, from the Silver Jews, that dude, I met him randomly in Nashville outside of The End, which is, like, a dive bar that a lot of touring bands play in Nashville, and I had a long conversation with him, and he was super kind, and I ended up emailing him, and a year later, right before we were going to make Pretty Years, he emailed me back out of the blue, using all of this crazy, like, Microsoft, like, Outlook, like, formatting and crazy, like, red background with blue text. And just, it was a truly wondrous, like, moment, because I've loved Silver Juice forever, but crazy email full of advice and, you know, just him kind of ruminating on what it means to write songs and write pop songs and write rock lyrics. And he said that writing songs now seems like kind of like washing the same dish over and over to him. And I kind of feel that way too sometimes. He also said that rock lyrics are going to get good all at once, like TV did. Mm. So I guess he means that there's going to be a Sopranos rock band, or, you know, something of that equivalent. So I don't know. I guess we need to wait and see what happens. But maybe rock will snap back into focus. Like maybe people will care about it again. But for the moment, yeah, it's marginalized, and, you know, top 40 and, you know, hip hop and, like, yeah, codeine hip hop are kind of the thing. But, you know, I just tell myself if I'm happy with the records that I make, then that's that. And other rock bands seem to have great, you know, some success, some, you know, and a following, and that's good.
Yeah. I mean, my addendum to Berman's comment about the dish is that even if it is like washing a dish over and over again, that dish keeps getting dirty. So it needs to be cleaned. And there are lots of us out there who need clean dishes, and we really appreciate the clean dishes. Even if, like, the media isn't focused on those people, they still exist, and there's still, like, a large number of people out there. So we appreciate the clean dishes that you are washing for us.
Well, I will continue to wash that dish for you.
Yeah, I wonder,
because I cannot do anything else.
You're
marketable skills.
You are a fine dishwasher, my friend.
Thank you, sir.
I want to just to get back to Pretty Years. It's interesting listening to the record in the context of this conversation, because again, I think it's a great record. I think, you know, if I can use the word accessible, it does seem maybe even a little bit more straightforward than Lose is. However, it doesn't strike me as a record that was made to just, like, pander to a big audience. Like, there's still, like, great touches on the record that make it eccentric and idiosyncratic. You know, I think of, like, that great sax part on the song Rise, I think it is.
Wish.
Yeah. That's the third song, I believe. That's, like, one of my favorite songs on the record. And, you know, again, you guys have reached the point in your career where you can make records that sound like you, and you have a signature that's very definite. And I feel like this record is sort of the confirmation of your signature, like the distinct sort of cymbals-y guitars type thing. I mean, when you're making a record like this, I mean, I imagine that you'd have to just kind of sit down and make the best record you can and not try to let these other sort of factors come into play with what you're doing, right? I mean, does that enter into play at all, like the career kind of concerns?
It sure does. But, I mean, yeah, I try to narrow my scope. We got back from touring for Luz at the beginning of September 2015, and that's when we began writing the next one. Matt Whipple, our bassist and co-writer on a bunch of songs on Pretty Years and Luz, he was just like, you know, we have a little bit of momentum from Luz. It was well received. Like, let's just sit down and write another record right away. Which is kind of a tall order because we were pretty burnt out from playing like 200 shows for Luz, but we did it. You know, we sat down and from September to March, we wrote this record. And we just tried to make it, we tried to kind of distill all the stuff that we think is interesting about what we do, I guess. And you're right, I mean, it is more direct, and I think that we were more conscious of that. You know, I wanted to continue writing songs with, you know, with choruses or with parts that repeat. We did a one-off single with Jesse Lacey from Brand New called Arrowbed, and kind of my takeaway from being produced like that was, you know, Jesse was just like, there are a lot of songwriters in the world, and most of them use this kind of template, you know, verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, chorus. Why don't you try it? And, you know, I mean, it's just kind of this idiot revelation that we had. We're like, hey, yeah, you know, like, let's try and do it this way. And it's been really fun. I mean, I can already tell we're going to have a really great time playing Pretty Years live, and we're going to be able to have like 5 beers while doing it.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
well, I'm looking forward to drinking 5 beers when I see you guys live next month. So yeah. I think it'll be a lot of fun. And again, I think if anyone takes anything from this podcast episode, it should be that that supporting your favorite bands is an important thing that has tangible results for the artists that you love. So buy records, buy t-shirts, go see your favorite bands live. It's important if you want them to continue to make music. So that's the point I think I'd like people to take from this episode.
I fully endorse that.
Well, Joe, it was so great talking with you, man. I really appreciate you making time to come on.
Oh, thank you, Steve. I hope I didn't ramble too much.
No, you were great.
All right, man.
All right, thanks. Take care.
All right.
Okay, that was Joseph D'Agostino. And Joseph, I am sorry, I might be butchering your last name. I am terrible at pronouncing names. I probably shouldn't even be hosting a podcast because I can barely talk sometimes when it comes to pronouncing people's names. But I can say Cymbals Eat Guitars, and I can say that they are a great band. And Pretty Years, a record that is coming out in September, I think is one of the best rock records of the year. So definitely check that out. And guys, thank you again for listening to this podcast. Again, you know, I'm so flattered and moved that you guys would listen to what we do here. We really appreciate your support. If you do want to help support the podcast, it's always great if you can tell your friends about us or talk about us on social media or, you know, give us a rating on iTunes or even a review on iTunes. You know, all these things help spread the word and help, you know, spread the Celebration Rock gospel. So you can do that. That's hugely helpful for us. Guys, thank you again for listening to this episode. It's been great talking at you, and we will see you again next week.